My name is Ron Cass, and I chair the Administrative Law and Regulatory Policy Group of the Federal Society. I'm delighted to welcome you to our panel today on the breakdown of the public-private distinction. I know a number of you saw the word breakdown and decided that this panel spoke directly to you. For those of you who are here for the psychotherapy, that will come at the very end of the session. I was in the grocery store a couple of days ago and was sent by my wife to pick up a few things. And I noticed on the aisle right in front of me, there was a woman with a small child, it looked like about a 2 or 3 year old little girl, in the basket. And as they were going down the aisle, the little girl was grabbing things and pulling them into the basket, and the mother was putting them back. And at one point, she put back a box of cereal, and the little girl began to cry. And the mother said, "Catherine, it's okay. You'll be out of here in a few minutes. We just have a little time in the store." They went down the next aisle, and it was the aisle I was on as well. And again, the same thing happened. The little girl was pulling things off, and the mother put them back, and the little girl cried and started screaming. And the mother said, "Catherine, it's okay. You'll be out of here in a few minutes. Just hang on." And, you know, after several different aisles, I was really impressed with the composure she had, and I went over to her and I said, "You know, I was really impressed at the way you dealt with your little girl, Catherine," at which point the mother said to me, "She's Elizabeth, I'm Catherine." There are times when things go awry and you're not quite sure what it is that is happening or how to deal with it. This past year, when we had the financial crisis and everyone decided very quickly something needed to be done, there was no shortage of answers as to what needed to be done and no shortage of different views as to how that would fix things. Of course, the route we took was that we began putting money, large amounts of money, into various companies and institutions. I remember in the film Austin Powers when Dr. Evil comes out of deep freeze and makes a demand, which he thinks is a great demand for $1 million, and then is informed that that isn't much money these days, and he, of course, adjusts it to $1 billion. And the government very quickly made the adjustment from billions to trillions. We used to think of billions of dollars as large amounts, and when the government is pouring hundreds of billions of dollars into individual companies, it kind of changes the landscape for us. Those of us who've been dealing with administrative law grew up with a system where you had private companies that were privately owned and privately run. And those companies were regulated to one degree or another by government, which was a separate enterprise. In today's world, we have a mixture where we have government as part owner and sometimes majority owner of companies that are also being regulated by other parts of the government. And the question we are asking today is, how will this work? What changes? What needs to be adjusted? We have a terrific panel of people who will speak to us this morning. I will introduce them all briefly, and then they will get up one after another. For ease of conversation, when you have questions at the end of this, you can just say, "David, could you answer this question?" Three out of the four are named David, and J.W. Barrett has agreed to be known as David for the balance of the panel. Our first speaker is going to be David Leitch. David is a graduate of Duke University and the University of Virginia School of Law, so he's hedged on basketball games in the ACC unless Carolina is playing. He clerked for J. Harvey Wilkinson on the Fourth Circuit and then for Chief Justice Rehnquist, and served in, after some time in private practice, he served in the Department of Justice as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel. He also held positions as Chief Counsel of the Federal Aviation Administration and as Deputy Counsel to the President when George W. Bush was in office. He's now general counsel of a privately owned automobile company, Ford Motor Company. And we'll have a few things to say about the impact of the financial investments and bailouts on that industry. David Barenboim is the Executive Vice President of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. He is a graduate of Touro Law School and Stony Brook. He has been looking very hard at questions of how the financial bailouts affect funding for mortgages and for people who want to acquire property. He has testified in both the House and the Senate on how to fix our current problems, and he assures me that he has the solution for anything that is wrong with the economy today. Maybe I overstate that a bit. David Ziering, our next speaker, is a graduate of Swarthmore and Harvard Law School. He clerked on the D.C. Circuit. He is currently an assistant professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He has written extensively on international economic regulation and administrative law topics. J.W. Vera, David, is a graduate of LSU, the Kennedy School, and Harvard Law School. He clerked for John Noble, the Vice Chancellor of the Delaware Court of Chancery, and he can do equity if you need it. He practiced at Skadden Arps. He is a Searle Kaufman Fellow at Northwestern and Assistant Professor of Law at George Mason University School of Law. And with that, let me turn it over to David.
Thank you. I'm going to stay seated if that's okay. Before I begin my remarks, I just want to make the obligatory statement that as the General Counsel of Ford Motor Company, my remarks here do not necessarily reflect the views of the company, the management of the company. Of course, I'd be disappointed if they didn't agree with them, but I'll let them speak for themselves on that. In describing the subject of this panel, the organizers of the conference gave us a little written paragraph on what they thought the panel ought to talk about. And the question, they said, was revolved around the basic regulatory model, which presupposes a private entity being regulated by a government agency. The new model, they said, has government owning some or even most of a private entity and exercising influence through both informal and formal mechanisms within the firm, while also having the traditional tools of regulatory control. They then asked whether this so-called new model presented special problems in figuring out how regulatory laws fit with those providing for investment, whether control will be more politicized and less transparent, and whether it changes the way courts should approach agency review, deference, or preemption. I'd like to focus my remarks on the premise that there is, in fact, a new model that is neatly contrasted to the basic regulatory model. To be sure, I quite agree that there is a basic regulatory model in the United States, as described, that of a private entity being regulated by a government entity. This model is at work in all of the classic forms of government regulation. To take an example that's close to home, Ford Motor Company, a public company in the traditional sense of the word, still a private entity vis-a-vis others in our industry, is closely regulated in terms of safety and fuel economy by NHTSA. NHTSA conducts traditional government rulemaking through notice and comment procedures. We participate through commenting, and it's the standard administrative procedure we've come to know and love, or at least know. So I don't take issue with the view that what is described as the basic regulatory model is in fact the basic regulatory model. What I do want to emphasize, however, are two very pertinent facts. First, that the basic regulatory model has always been subject to a variety of variations that blurred the line between public and private. And second, that there is, in fact, no new model, but rather a variety of different and largely untested arrangements that have resulted from the sort of ad hoc decision-making that occurred during the financial crisis of the past year. And it's the unbridled nature of that decision-making that I believe should concern us. Let me begin with a bit of history. Writing for the court in 1995 in a case called LeBron versus National Railroad Passenger Association, better known as Amtrak, Justice Scalia recounted the history of the government's involvement with entities that have the corporate structure. He noted that there is a long history going back to the First Bank of the United States of what he called corporations created and participated in by the United States for the achievement of governmental objectives. While time will not permit us to recount that history here, it is fair to say that the government's creation, acquisition, and use of corporations has been cyclical. It increases during times of crisis, and it is followed by periods of reform. The first widespread use of government corporations came during World War I, and other large increases in this form of government action came during the Great Depression and the Second World War. Periods in which government corporations rapidly proliferate generally lead to periods of retrenchment and reform. The most notable period of reform came at the end of World War II. At that time, there were, by one count, 58 government corporations with total assets of approximately $30 billion in 1945 dollars. In response to the largely uncontrolled growth of government corporations, Congress enacted the Government Corporation Control Act, which both dramatically cut back on the number of government corporations and increased the transparency and accountability of those that remained by imposing various budget, audit, and debt management practices. In the years that followed, the government both created new corporations, such as ComSat and Amtrak, and from time to time became involved in private corporations. Perhaps the most prominent example of the latter was the government's takeover and reorganization of the freight railroad system through the creation of Conrail. Through this long history, the government's involvement with both government-created and government-controlled corporations took on many different characteristics. The government appointed some or all of the boards of directors of these entities. Some were designated as agencies of the United States, while others were expressly designated not to be agencies or instrumentalities of the United States. Some were owned or controlled entirely by private parties, while others were owned or controlled primarily by the government. And when Congress created or authorized federal corporations, it expressly established whether laws such as FOIA, the APA, and the Government Corporation Control Act applied. The point of all this is that there has long been a blurring of the line between public and private entities in this country. The basic regulatory model has often been adjusted as government involves itself in corporate entities. But while this involvement has been the subject of great variation, the characteristics and obligations of any particular corporation and the relationship of that corporation to the government itself were, so far as I can tell, universally the subject of careful consideration by Congress, and it has always provided detailed legislation on the subject. Then came General Motors and Chrysler and AIG and others. In the interest of time, I will focus just on GM, which is of obvious interest to me. The vehicle for the government's takeover of GM was, of course, the TARP, which authorized the Secretary of the Treasury to purchase troubled assets from any financial institution. That is the authority that the government used to inject nearly $50 billion of money into General Motors, because Congress created a broad enough definition of financial institution that the Secretary of the Treasury was able to reach a determination upheld by the courts that General Motors was in fact a financial institution within the meaning of TARP. On the basis of that authority and precious little else, the government injected $50 billion into General Motors, required GM to go through bankruptcy, fired the CEO of General Motors, converted the vast majority of this investment into equity, thereby freeing GM of the obligation to generate cash to repay its obligations, determined that the appropriate government ownership of General Motors was precisely 60.8%, and that the UAW Healthcare Trust should own 17.5% of General Motors, and secured the right to name four members of General Motors' board. And my point for today is not whether this is good or bad public policy. It's certainly the subject of a lot of debate. But for those who care deeply about the legitimacy of governmental exercises of power, I would offer two very important observations. First, all of this was done on the thinnest of legal reeds. The exercise was not the subject of debate and lawmaking within Congress of the sort that has traditionally been the basis for government involvement in corporations. Indeed, when Congress considered a rescue of the automotive companies late last year, it rather clearly declined to pass such a law. It was only after a bill cleared the House but died in the Senate that the executive stepped in to use TARP. And the decisions the executive branch made were wholly unguided by anything but its own determinations of good and bad policy. We heard Judge Ginsburg last night talk about the demise of the non-delegation doctrine. One can hardly imagine a clearer example of a raw exercise of government power with no discernible standard in law. By what standard did the administration act? None but its own judgment about what best served its policy and political aims. For this purpose, TARP was literally a blank check. So to the extent this panel was asked to discuss the implications of a new model for the public-private partnership, there's simply no model at all. The model is whatever the executive decides suits its purposes in the moment. Second, looking forward, there's absolutely no guidance in law for many questions that might arise from the government's ownership of 60.8% of General Motors. How should the government manage its stake in GM? What are its rights and duties going forward? What are the government's appropriate goals? Is it interested in getting out of GM as quickly as possible, or should its goal be to maximize the taxpayers' recovery of their investment? How does the government's ownership in GM and Chrysler impact its regulation and interaction with competitors of those enterprises who didn't receive government money? Is the government obligated to treat those companies even-handedly, or may the government favor the companies that it has decided to own? Even if it pledges even-handed treatment, what checks should be in place to ensure such treatment? How transparent should the government be? How transparent should GM be? Is GM permitted, as it appears to be poised to do, to spend U.S. taxpayer money to fund its businesses in Germany, Brazil, and China? The government has, of course, attempted to answer many of these questions, but again, the answers are not in any way guided by what we would recognize as the rule of law, and certainly do not bind the government. Shouldn't the taxpayers' investment of scores of billions of dollars be controlled by legally binding rules developed through the Constitution's lawmaking process? I would close simply by saying this. If the new model for public-private partnerships is the open-ended and unguided example we see in the automotive industry, the implications for the administrative state are extreme. The structures, principles, and rules of law that have long been developed and applied would be replaced by extreme deference to the executive that says, trust me to make the right decisions and do the right things going forward. Now, I'm all for a robust executive within the structure of our government. This approach, however, rewrites the structure in ways we should not countenance. I think it's incumbent upon Congress not simply to observe, report, and cajole, often on a representative-by-representative basis, but rather to make laws to guide this investment going forward. I think that's the model that we deserve. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. After listening to the morning panel, which I thought was a wonderful colloquy on some of the issues in the financial services sector, I actually put aside my remarks because I wanted to respond to some of the issues raised, such as regarding a consumer financial protection agency, how we got into this mess, potentially some of the solutions to the crisis, but also to talk about where we are right now and how do we move ahead in a way that's constructive. The National Community Reinvestment Coalition, close to a decade ago, testified before Senator Sarbanes and the Senate Banking Committee at the nation's first hearing on the issue of predatory lending. I remember the hearing very, very distinctly because to my left and right were representatives from the nation's major trade associations serving the banking industry, the mortgage broker industry, appraisers, and others. And we all agreed, if in fact this nation, if our regulators, if we all as citizens and corporations would comply with existing statutory and regulatory authority, there would be no need for, in fact, a new national anti-predatory lending law. That was the beginning of our current crisis that we are facing today. The issues then were single premium credit life, no income verification loans, and a host of other issues. Was pricing fair based on risk? Was there discrimination in lending or not? But those issues of that day have now morphed into issues of regulatory failure, of economic malaise, and other issues that we must contend with today. Relative to the topic of this panel, quite candidly, there is no private sector mortgage industry at this time. If this year you applied for a mortgage, it was purchased and securitized by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or FHA 90% of the time. The market is frozen because of the crisis that we are in. So how did we get to this point? What led to it? Earlier, we heard about some of the remarks that Chairman Greenspan made during his tenure. He spoke to greed and malfeasance in the system. Frankly, it was well known. NCRC has filed grievances, complaints to HUD against three of the major nation's rating agencies. They're not publishers. In fact, investors were relying on their ratings time and time again for the investments they were making. It was well known for up to 3 years that subprime paper was not worth the paper it was printed on, but they continued to give AAA ratings to those industries. With all due respect, though the SEC has been a leader in many issues, where was the SEC at that time? We are full of regulators. We have too many regulators. This week, Chairman Dodd has probably done the most significant thing that we have observed during the entire debate about financial reform. Whether you agree or disagree with his proposal, he is proposing very, very significant change. And the underlying issues are the issues that we as counsel, the lobbyists on the Hill, and everyone is watching. Assignee liability, preemption, holder in due course are all intertwined on these issues. Who will be regulated by whom and what authority will they have? Where will there be a transparency? Where will there be accountability? The fact of the matter, a pure vision to address consumer issues, to address risk in the marketplace, to look quite candidly at resolution authority, and all of the other proposals he is making are quite unique. The bill that came out of the House ultimately was watered down to such a point, you may be surprised, that we at the National Community Reinvestment Coalition view it as an enigma, similar to, in fact, some of the major, major business trade associations in the United States. There's no reason banks or community banks should be treated than financial service corporations, and we all should be working for safe and sound lending that is responsible at its core. My typical day at NCRC is on two fronts. I work to coordinate our fair lending and our consumer protection programs. We operate with 40 organizations around the nation, a rescue program, a foreclosure prevention program. Why is it that I see time and time again homeowners who were given option ARM products and who are also then given a home equity line of credit to buy their home? Now let's break the myth that you heard earlier by one of the presenters in the first panel. This is not a crisis brought about by lending to African Americans or low to moderate income consumers. The Federal Reserve and others have documented in many reports that only 6% of the high cost loans that were originated by banking institutions regulated by the Community Reinvestment Act. The truth of the matter is, if the Community Reinvestment Act is expanded, as under H.R. 1479, we would not be in the mess that we are in today, because safety and soundness, which is part of the two-page document of CRA, is required by every regulator who enforces that law. These are very difficult times right now. Clearly, Glamleach Bliley and how it, frankly, deregulated Glass-Steagall played a very important role here. We need to take a fresh look at what's happening, frankly, on all issues. If we have an enforcement regulatory regime and a statutory regime that promotes responsible lending, it's win-win for communities, consumers, and, frankly, industry alike. We believe in that dialogue. We think it's constructive to the regulatory process that we are in right now. What's happening in the absence of that? We have a marketplace that's dominated by the government. How many billions is the Federal Reserve, over $400 billion, putting into liquidity to buy loans right now? What is happening right now relative to the marketplace as a whole? Look at the City of Baltimore litigation against Wells Fargo. That case is just the first of what will be, I believe, a series of tobacco-type litigations filed by municipalities who saw disparities, discrimination in lending that has now led to foreclosure, that ultimately is lowering the tax base and prompting a major increase in taxes nationwide. Next year, the major part of the bubble is going to hit. And again, it wasn't from subprime. It wasn't for low to moderate income consumers. And this is not my data or NCRC's or any other advocacy organization. It comes from Credit Suisse and a host of other government companies. The option arm bubble is about to hit. between 2010 and 2011, white, middle-income, relatively affluent consumers around the nation are about to face foreclosure because their $800 to $1,200 mortgage payments are about to adjust up to between $1,900 and $3,500 per month. We are not through this issue yet. And until the government begins to address issues that will, in fact, address the bad debt that, frankly, investors, banks, and others are holding, whether it's a good bank, bad bank solution, or another approach, using the marketplace to use reverse auctions to acquire loans at value and then modify them. There are many different models that are being discussed. Until the market begins to discuss that, combined with regulatory restructuring, our economy is going to continue to, in fact, struggle. On the commercial side, the retail side, many of the big box developments, many of the corporate developments that you see across the country were developed with similar, frankly, non-traditional products that are now defaulting on the residential side. Until we address this issue for actually the investor as well as the resident and small business holder, we are not going to get through the current economic crisis. Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. What I'm going to do in my short opening remarks is talk a little bit about the theme of the panel, about the government's initial response to the financial crisis, and then I'll touch on three current issues that are live, and they include executive compensation, resolution authority, and investment management by the government. Okay, so the panel is about the blurred line between the public sector and the private sector, and I think my theme in this talk will be, should we worry so much about the blurring of that line? I've often wondered whether bureaucrats who work for the government are so different from bureaucrats who work for IBM. And I've often wondered whether the networkers on Capitol Hill are so different from the networkers on Wall Street. Some are looking to sell a bill, and others are looking to sell a company. And, you know, I've also wondered if it's true what they say, that Washington is Hollywood for ugly people. So if those things are the case, you know, what is it organizationally that would make us worry about setting up a public sector that looked like a private sector, and also on occasion involving the public sector and private sector type activities? Indeed, I sort of welcome an organization of the public sector anyway along more private sector lines. Okay, so the government's response to the financial crisis was, to be sure, a stretch of certain Depression-era statutes, as David has noted, creative interpretation at times of the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act and the TARP, and a use of deal-making and agencies like the Fed and the Treasury Department that don't ordinarily follow the usual prescriptions of the Administrative Procedure Act and judicial review to get around those rules of administrative procedure. So that sounds alarming, but let's face it, the initial response to the financial crisis appears to be working. A collapse of the credit markets was forestalled, at least for now. Although the government, through the Fed and the Treasury Department, deployed a dizzying array of tools, some of which worked and some of which didn't, and some of which were particularly creative interpretations of statutory authority, if you're going to give people flexibility on how they implement their missions and then hold them accountable for their results, which is a management technique we teach quite early at the Wharton School and one adopted by the last presidential administration, then I'm not so sure we should worry so much about the basics of that financial response and instead judge it based on its results. So what about today? What about once we've made it to a bailout, the fallout and the blurring of the public-private distinction that currently exists? So what I'm going to do is, I think I have more equanimity about some of these issues than most of the people, but I'm going to raise three of those issues and say why you might want to worry about them and then describe why I'm less worried than you may be. So what about executive compensation? Basically, executive compensation, as it's been implemented by Kenneth Feinberg, is the public regulation of private ordering. Indeed, some of the most fundamental aspects of private ordering, contracts of employment between private actors. So that sounds pretty bad. What Kenneth Feinberg did for the companies he has been overseeing is he's reduced pay packages and tried to make them so that they vest in a long-term way. That's pretty dramatic, but let's face it, what the Feinberg mandate and remit was to adjust the compensation of all of 7 companies that had achieved extraordinary relief, been given extraordinary amounts of relief under the TARP. Feinberg has said, and the Treasury Department has said, that they hope it'll be a model for the future. And the Federal Reserve has told financial institutions that it will be issuing guidance, which, along the lines of the PAYSAR, or so-called PAYSAR's recommendations and requirements of the 7 companies receiving extraordinary assistance, will be focused on making pay long deferred and trying to do more to align the interests of corporate executives with shareholders. But all I'd say about this dramatic imposition is, first of all, of the public sector and the private sector, is first of all that it's worth noting that it's only been applied to a few firms so far, 7 in the case of the PAYSAR, not all the firms receiving TARP money. And as for the Federal Reserve, they've issued only guidance, but no hard rules about executive compensation. Secondly, you might ask if you wouldn't reduce the compensation paid to executives if you were, say, a private equity firm that owned 7 companies that had failed during a recession or all but failed. You might try to hold those executives accountable, and it's not clear to me that that isn't part of what the Feinberg pay compensation rules are doing. Okay, so what about resolution authority? Well, this is really striking power that is claimed by the government. And in the Dodd bill, it's a striking power that would be broadened to cover not just banks and thrifts, but all sorts of financial institutions. It's a striking power because it allows the government to come in and seize, that is, nationalize, a private company. And there's no pre-deprivation process, and there's very little post-deprivation compensation. So once again, the question is, should you worry? And should you worry, especially if the bargain that the government has extracted for resolution authority, that is the granting of a valuable thrift or bank charter in exchange for the ability to take that charter away, essentially, at any moment, whether that bargain is sort of being changed if resolution authority is expanded not to deal with just banks and thrifts, but with a variety of financial companies that don't make money on the basis of their valuable bank or thrift charters, like insurance companies like AIG, or other financial institutions. The Treasury Department has suggested if it gets the resolution authority it wants, it's possible that some hedge funds or private equity funds involved in banking involved in the ownership of financial institutions could be subject to the resolution authority discipline. So I think this is very dramatic government intervention, and I think that if resolution authority is passed in an extended way, it ought to be accompanied with a published list of companies covered by the potential for resolution authority at the beginning. And perhaps at the end, there ought to be an auction process once a company is seized, whereby its owners could try to buy it back before it is dispatched. But it's worth noting that resolution authority is, though dramatic government intervention, hardly unprecedented government intervention. The FDIC has been resolving failed institutions for years, and so state banking regulators. And also, it's worth noting that resolution authority is not going to become the only thing that the government does when it gets involved in the financial regulatory system. The government had strong resolution authority powers over Fannie and Freddie, and it hasn't yet deployed them, and my suspicion is it will not. So it's also worth noting that constitutionally, this power is being upheld time and again, and that may be because it is, as I've said, a power of long-standing existence, one that existed before the procedural revolution and Goldberg versus Kelly, one that I think may continue to exist in the future, but I would agree that resolution authority is something worth taking a close look at. Okay, so the final thing I wanted to talk about a little bit was investment management by government supervisors, and I think Jay Verrett will talk about this in more detail, and so I'll leave it to him to handle most of the issues. But it's possible that the government will retain a stake in the companies it's involved itself with longer than absolutely necessary to maximize the net asset value of the corporation or to ensure its safety and soundness. The idea here is that the Federal Reserve Board or the Treasury Department may forbid a bank from paying back its TARP funds until it hits a capital adequacy level well above, say, 9%. Or it may be the case that the government stays in companies like AIG and Chrysler for years until their insurance and car businesses come back, if they ever do. That's a lot of government ownership and more than absolutely necessary. But again, I ask you to think about whether you would want a private sector company to sell before it had maximized the net asset value on its investment. It's also worth noting that capital adequacy has also been around for a very long time, at least since the 1970s and probably informally before then. Okay, so finally, I guess I'd say that it's worth noting that people go to jail after financial crises. And the savings and loan crisis, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, which is today's Office of Thrift Supervision, referred 11,000 cases to the Department of Justice for prosecution. And that was in 2 years. In 1992, there'd been 1,000 convictions of Cessnel executives and a reported conviction rate of 91%. And the GAO concluded that of the largest 26 thrift failures, 60% of them had been marred by serious criminal activity. So one of the things that's most interesting about the private sector's response to the public sector and the financial crisis is that there doesn't appear to be a real worry about the political risk inherent in retaining some of the practices that existed before the financial meltdown. You may say to yourself, well, thrifts are Main Street, and Wall Street's more politically juiced. But there's been no conviction so far, no successful ones, almost none, of financial executives in the aftermath of this crisis. And there are 3 grand juries investigating now. I suspect there will be more to come. So to me, it's interesting to note that companies like Goldman Sachs are still compensating their executives and employees at the high rates they were compensating them before the crisis. And it suggests to me that that the appetite for risk, including political risk and the risk of criminal prosecution, still exists in some of these large financial companies. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm reminded of a story about one of my favorite figures of the Revolutionary War, Colonel Ethan Allen. Just after he was beginning to retire and he was finishing up a good career at the State Department in the early part of the 19th century, he was dispatched to the United Kingdom to negotiate a trade deal. And in order to try to get the best of him, his counterparties in the negotiation hung a giant portrait of George Washington in the privy, in the outhouse. And every time he would return from it, they would sort of wait for a reaction and hope he would get him hot and he would sort of mix him up in the negotiations. But he wouldn't let him show. He wouldn't let it, them have the satisfaction. And eventually they asked him. They said, "Colonel Allen, what whatsoever do you think of our portrait of your leader?" And he said, "Well, I rather think it's appropriate, and I rather think that's the only place we can hang it." They said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, in my experience, nothing makes an Englishman have knee of the privy quite so quickly as the sight of General Washington." And so I wonder if perhaps, as part of the solution to the moral hazard problems of bailouts, we might have a new policy to hang a portrait of Ken Feinberg and Secretary Paulson in the executive washrooms at Bank of America and GM and some of the other TARP recipients. And I think that's a policy that I think I could actually support. So in some ways, I'm a bit of a strange invite for this panel because I'm a pure corporate guy and securities guy, so this is an administrative law panel, and many times over the last year, I found myself feeling like I've taken a wrong turn on the scholarship highway and coming up against constitutional law and administrative law questions, and I think that's going to continue. And I think guys like me are going to be interacting with guys like David a lot more often, which in David's case is good. In my case, it's good with David. Maybe not necessarily everyone in the field that's not nearly as interesting as corporate law, I would say. But there'll be much more interaction, And I think this comes from the fact that the government's ownership in TARP recipients and the government's very powerful ownership in TARP recipients. Now, the government owns common voting equity in GM and Citigroup. The government owns preferred shares in the other TARP recipients. And the government owns common equity also in GMAC. Now, I would say that the unique thing about this analysis is that the government has become effectively a control shareholder. That's a very special term in corporate law, and it's something that you don't want to be. Control shareholders are treated very specially by corporate and securities law, and they're reviewed. Their actions are reviewed very significantly. Now, how do we determine control for this purpose? Well, percentage ownership is where we begin, but you certainly can have control as a sub-majority owner. And so I think, for instance, at 34% for the government's ownership in Citigroup, I think it's a very easy case to say that the government's a control shareholder there. I think it can go even lower. Courts have looked to, for securities cases and corporate cases, co-status as a creditor, and I think that obviously would apply very easily to the Treasury Department. I think the unique thing about the government as a shareholder is that it, of course, also regulates these companies, and that's something other shareholders aren't going to do. It makes the analysis a lot more easy. And I think we can make a colorable claim that even at sub 10% ownership, the government can be exercising shareholder control. This is very difficult under corporate securities law. If you are a control shareholder, you have the same fiduciary duty, it turns out, as the board of directors and the executives of the company to the other shareholders to maximize shareholder wealth. Under securities laws, you have joint and several liability with the company for violations of the securities laws. So control shareholder is not a fun status to have under those aspects of the law. The unique thing that the government gets, though, is sovereign immunity. And so that really changes the dynamic completely. It makes it very difficult. Now, the analysis on whether sovereign immunity attaches to the government's exercise of shareholder power is it's extensive, and I haven't even fully answered all of the unique questions that come out there. I've got a paper on this, Treasury Incorporated, I'll make a shameless plug for. You can Google it and go take a look if you want more of this. But I think while there might be some cases where a clever plaintiff's lawyer might have a fighting chance, the sovereign immunity protections for government's exercise of shareholder power are pretty firm. I think it'd be tough to make a claim under the Tucker Act, the Tort Claims Act. Beyond that, the Emergency Economic Stability Act is quite clear about a broad reservation of sovereign immunity protection, and also Section 3C of the Securities Exchange Act explicitly exempts the U.S. government from application of the 34 Act, of the act that includes, among other things, the restriction on insider trading. Now, there are some strange consequences for corporate theory that come about with the government's ownership. I'll skip those for now and save those for the panel across the hall, the folks at the panel across the hall to talk about at maybe a later date. But in terms of corporate practice and the odd occurrences that happen when government is an owner in private companies, first of all, with respect to insider trading, you know, a bureaucrat at the Treasury Department is perfectly free. The folks at the Financial Stability Office at Treasury are perfectly free to engage in insider trading on the TARP shares that they own in Citigroup and all the other TARP recipients, completely immune from insider trading liability. Now, for be it for me to be a strong advocate of insider trading, my law school was founded by a guy who made his name developing scholarship about how insider trading might at times be efficient. But I think in a world, we can all agree, in a world where insider trading is illegal for everyone else, it's going to cause some significant economic distortions for one very strong shareholder to have an immunity from insider trading liability. Deal approvals might become difficult because when you have a control shareholder, corporate law considers that you don't really necessarily have independent directors, and independent directors can be very important for improving deals in mergers and acquisitions, and so that might become difficult, I think, going forward. Affiliated sales, this is another thing that sovereign immunity won't protect against because it's not the government that would be the target of this sort of action. But affiliated sales, for instance, if Bank of America or Citigroup held Rule 144 securities, exempt securities, in GM and wanted to sell them, the fact that they share a control shareholder, at least in my view, would make them affiliated sales. They're very difficult to do. You have to register affiliated sales. You have to deliver proxy statements, and it can be very expensive. The penalty for not fulfilling all your obligations there is rescission. So that's much higher damages than you get anywhere else in securities law. If I were not in this business and in the plaintiff's law business, or maybe if I don't get tenure, I'll go into this business, I would frankly try to find some buyers of Rule 144 securities and seek rescission damages. I'm surprised we haven't seen that yet, frankly. Class actions, right? CalPERS is a lead plaintiff in a lot of class action litigation. Is Treasury going to do that too? Are they going to join it? Or are they going to lead it? There's quite a conflict there because Treasury has an interest in propping up these banks at the same time. Are they going to form it out to who? To plaintiff's lawyers? They're very big in terms of political contributions, so that could get a little bit sticky. Right? Are they going to let the DOJ do it? Are they going to let the SEC do it? A lot of class actions piggyback on SEC enforcement actions, so how exactly is that going to work? But overall, I think the broad, really, question is off-balance sheet subsidies. I think when we see governments do things that don't necessarily comport with long-term wealth maximization, it's the sort of things, that the problems that we see at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that a lot of folks have studied for 10 or 15 years and that Peter Wallison has been warning us about from the very beginning. And I think the way that we look at that is going to change. And I think that brings in also issues about federal budgetary policy and whether it's a good idea to bring more of the debt and liabilities and also the assets of TARP recipients onto the federal budget. I mean, in private sector accounting, if a parent controls a subsidiary, there are rules requiring that parent to bring that subsidiary's books onto the parent's books. So I think now that government is acting like a private investor, the lessons of private sector accounting, I think, ought to apply. Questions I would pose for administrative and constitutional law going forward, what happens when the government uses its shareholder power to implicitly regulate? Sort of like I'm a fan of the Godfather movies, and what I learned from that is that the best kind of power to have is the power where you don't even have to ask people to do things. They guess what you want them to do, and then they go ahead and do them. So what happens for administrative law there? How can you FOIA request, a CEO deciding to do something because he figured Treasury wanted it to happen because it's an election year and maybe making cheaper loans in battleground states is probably what Treasury wants us to do, and maybe we can get better loans from Treasury in the future because of it. So is there hope? I would offer that there is hope. Senator Corker and Senator Warner have introduced the TARP Recipient Ownership Trust Act. I think it's a brilliant bill because I helped to write some of it. Some of the parts of it aren't my favorite because it's, like every bill, it's a product of negotiation and pushback from Treasury. Some provisions, though, that are interesting, we'll see if it passes. We'll see if it gets to the floor even with the distractions of the healthcare debate. First, any TARP recipient over 10%, in which the government has over 10% interest, not including Federal Reserve investments, would be covered, would create a trust managed by three trustees, a requirement to sell out by 2011, by December 2011, which I think is very promising. There's a provision for exception where you could fast track something through Congress to continue TARP for a while if there's some sort of an emergency, but there's at least a goal in the statute of selling out by December 2011. Three trustees, similar. At first, it seemed similar to the AIG Trust. I was very critical of the AIG Trust. I testified with the three trustees. And in fact, before the hearing, we were all very friendly and talking. And then afterwards, maybe not quite so friendly. I think in the trust, the AIG Trust had a provision to the fiduciary duties of the trustees was to maximize, was not to maximize shareholder value. It was to do whatever's in the best interest of the Treasury. And I was very critical of that as being meaningless and only having meaning to the extent that the Treasury Secretary defines it for you. The fiduciary duty in this new trust created that would be created by Corker Warner would have a fiduciary duty to maximize the value of the shares, so I think that's beneficial. There's a limit on indemnification for trustees to only good faith attempts to maximize that value. There was no such limit on indemnification in the AIG trust. Now, there is the question, again, and this is not included in the trust, but I think it's an important academic question, and to me that word means the most important thing. Academics are probably different from what it means to all of you. Private rights of action, right? What does fiduciary duty mean if we don't have private rights of action? There's currently no provision for that in Corker Warner. Taxpayer standing, it's obviously a very difficult kind of thing to manage. It can be very costly. But what about this? What about if we had standing just for the 50 state AGs to sue on behalf of their state pensions for investments in TARP recipients? They could sue the TARP trustees if they thought the trustees were caving to political pressure from Treasury to engage in off-balance sheet subsidies. Maybe that might work. Maybe that might be a manageable way to do private rights of action. I've been pushing for that. Of course, Treasury doesn't think that's a great idea. But I do, and so I highly recommend you write to your congressman about Corker Warner and tell them to support it. And I look forward to your questions at the end of the session.
Well, our panel members have given us a lot to think about. I was particularly struck by David Zering's comment that Washington is Hollywood for ugly people. I was born in Washington. Happened to work in Washington. I also wanted to say to J.W., who said he's a corporate securities guy on an administrative law panel, you should feel perfectly welcome as someone who specializes in two subfields of administrative law. They're all subfields of administrative law. We have a lot of time for questions from the audience. We have a lot to talk about from what the panelists have given us. If you want to ask a question, please come up to the microphone, introduce yourself, be gentle with our panelists. I've told them that if they have good questions from you, I'll double what they're getting for appearing here today. Let me start. Tom? You have to introduce yourself, though.
Tom Hayden, Cocoa Wildlife Association. I hate to start with questions that involve personal anecdotes, but I'm going to violate that rule. Listening very interestingly to David Fairmont's comments, because I have...
Is that microphone on?
Hello? Okay. Anybody hear me?
Do we... That actually is a government-owned microphone. It's not.
Purely or partially? No. Anyway, the personal story, personal anecdote.
We have someone here to fix the mic.
Yeah. Can everybody hear me?
Here, you want to use this one?
Just keep going.
Either in financial markets or in private industry, in general, is that a market in which only 10% of all Americans can get mortgages will be politically unacceptable, even if it's economically rational. So the concern I have that you see in the GM situation, that you're going to see in the reaction to the way mortgage markets are working now, is a government acting in a proprietary capacity as the owner of these businesses is going to manage them for political ends, for the ends of satisfying as many voters as possible, as opposed to making the economically rational decisions that a private market would make. So I'd ask people to react.
Let me start with two of our Davids, because I think you touched on both the mortgage lending and the investment in General Motors there. I think certainly our first two panelists might want to crack at that, and then if our other two do as well.
Well, first I'll respond to the 10% versus 90%. The situation we are in now is unacceptable. We need a robust marketplace where the private sector is the originator, where liquidity, where securitization, where all of the processes work. Chairman Frank in discussing his legislation, suggested that originators need to have skin in the game, meaning they continue to hold a percentage of the loan throughout the securitization process. I think that issue points to some of the problems that we've seen. If you look at, for example, Countrywide, AmeriQuest, New Century, and a host of other companies who are no longer in existence or part of other companies today, most of their products were being securitized to Wall Street with very little oversight or appropriate loan origination controls. That created the problem that we're in today. The issue is one of responsible lending, of good business practice, as well as appropriate oversight. And that's the challenge for us as we move ahead. I agree, financial reform is not likely to pass this year, but next year I think you're going to see a lot of movement on that front.
I would just comment, you talked about the you know, the fact that government will manage its investments in response to political imperatives. I don't mind the government responding politically, but I think it's the form of that response. Is it a few people in the Treasury Department exercising what they think is the appropriate role in GM or AIG, the ownership structure, the, you know, the long-term and short-term inputs into that, what those companies do? Or is it something that should be actually addressed through the process of, you know, the rule of law and what we in our society expect when these kinds of taxpayer monies are being used, when these kinds of big political decisions are being made, not on the basis of determining that GM is a financial institution and therefore having unlimited authority, but rather having a debate in Congress, having a law passed, having standards that should be applied. If we decide that GM or AIG should be managed in a certain way through that process, sure, there are going to be political inputs, but that's the way that the government's supposed to function. That's the structure that our government is established around, and not this sort of just, you know, literally a blank check that says as much as you decide to spend on GM within a $700 billion kitty that you've got access to, and in any way that you decide to spend it under any conditions that you want for any purposes that you think are appropriate, and to be unwound in the way that you decide, you know, and without any transparency.
Sure, I'll just briefly say I would echo that concern, and I think that the issue is one of accountability. I think it's about you know, the tenure of an administration is short. The tenure of an assistant secretary is even shorter. I mean, we're talking 2 or 3 years here. So you hope that you try to get as much interest group you know, support as you can for the interest groups that you serve, and then you know, hope that you can pass on the hot potato to the next guy, and it explodes while he's there, and you're long gone and enjoying the benefits of you know, the private sector again. And so I think it's an issue of accountability. I think it's the fact that when a CEO is government-owned and when it's given social mandates alongside profit maximization mandates, life gets pretty easy, because when the balance sheet doesn't look good, the CEO could say, well, you know, I should get a bonus, obviously, because I was engaging in the social welfare goals that you gave to me. And then when times are good, you can say, well, I should get a bonus now because, you know, we made profits this year. And so I think it limits accountability. I think it infects the accountability mechanisms that we have in place for private sector objectives. And I think if the evidence from around the world is overwhelming, it teaches us anything, I think it's overwhelmingly clear that government ownership in private banks is bad for the bank in terms of earnings. I think in some places in Asia, a 10% increase in government ownership corresponds with a 3% decrease in earnings for the bank. I think it affects access to credit, and I think it affects overall GDP. We'll see correlations with all of those variables, the negative correlations with government ownership in banks.
Correlation with my investment in stocks. It correlates with a negative effect on earnings. In fact, some people actually have asked me what I'm planning on investing in for just that reason.
Jay Schweikert, Harvard Law School. Professor Zarian, you've suggested that there maybe we shouldn't be too concerned about the blurring of the public-private line. And my question relates to some of the concerns that Professor Verrett has mentioned, but it's a bit more of a fundamental question that I've sadly learned may be a bit of an antiquated question today, but I'll ask it anyway. When talking about the public-private distinction, isn't the fundamental question here, the fundamental distinction, the fact that, you know, the public sector is operating on the basis of government coercion and the private sector needs to operate on the basis of voluntary cooperation? And I understand that, you know, there may be complicated questions of fiduciary duty or complicated questions of fraud or even voluntariness even of itself may be a bit of a sticky question today, but isn't there still just this fundamental categorical difference between the way that, you know, Washington bureaucrats and Wall Street bureaucrats interact in this nature? And shouldn't we really be addressing that fundamental question before going to the specifics of, you know, private sector policy or public sector policy?
David, you want to take that?
Sure, I'll give it a shot. So that seems very different, doesn't it? That the government makes you do stuff and has the police power that can force you to do stuff, and the private sector doesn't. I wonder, in a day of increasingly complicated institutional relationships, whether it still makes sense to draw that broad line between public sector and private sector in even the marketplace. Now, I'm no fan of nationalized companies. I don't want to go back to the United Kingdom in the 1970s or whatever. But it seems to me that when the government takes an ownership stake in companies, it has a couple of options. First, it can use that ownership stake to pursue political ends, say, give something to a favored union, or manage the company so that it, as Jay suggests, makes loans to battleground states, or it can try to maximize the return on its investment. The question you're asking is, will it obviously choose the former path? And to me, it's just much less obvious that it'll do so in this day and age. I think the government spends TARP money somewhat cautiously. Well, I don't know about that, but I mean, it's going to pay a political price for losing money on the TARP investment, which it, by the way, surely will on General Motors and Chrysler. But government's returns are open to all. When companies began paying back their TARP funds with interest, that was viewed as a win for the government. And I don't think that the political process here is the kind of process where you can direct Bank of America to start making loans in Detroit or, you know, battleground states, Ohio, without paying a massive political price for that sort of thing. So the question is, will the government try to do a good job and maximize the return on its investment, or do a political job and pursue short-term but immediately favored interests? You know, it's not clear to me whether the government won't try to do the former, and it's not clear to me that if they do the latter, whether the long-term givers of the money that the government's selling, deploying, whether they won't hold the government accountable.
If I can, I actually have to say, I would have thought that the question whether politicians would behave politically would be one of those rhetorical questions that you posed. It's sort of asking, you know, whether lions will behave like carnivores. We've had an awful lot of experience over the years with this, and I would have thought that was one of those questions that wouldn't be readily debatable. David,
I think you're asking your comments. Go to the question of whether this will work well or not. I mean, in your opening remarks, you said, you know, there's no reason to think it won't succeed. It appears to be succeeding. But I think we also need to focus on the question of, is it legitimate, and who decides? We are, after all, talking about, you know, billions and billions of dollars of taxpayer money. And it may work. But we're counting on a very small group of people with almost no direction to make the decisions. And they may do it in a way that we look back and say, well, it all seemed to have worked. But there's no guarantee of that. And there's no consensus or anything approaching law that governs how they're spending this money.
I think there's another aspect to this, lessons learned. We have the government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which had private investors and, of course, government guarantees. Now, for 40 years, they did a lot of very good work, but look what happened the last 5 years of that lifespan. We, the taxpayers, are very much holding the bag. Now, they had a legitimate government purpose, but the profit motive, if you look at the loans that ultimately brought the companies down, Fannie and Freddie were trying to compete against the private sector, particularly in the Alt-A or subprime marketplace, and those were the first portfolios to go bad. And it's an interesting hybrid of the question, you know, public role versus private role in a hybrid type of organization, which Congress will be turning to as they try to figure out what to do with Fannie and Freddie in the coming year.
Hi, Mark Holmes of the U.S. Tax Court. I have a question for which I hope either Professor Zering or Dean Cass have an easy explanation. But at what point, or is there a point, at which a corporation that is controlled by the federal government becomes an authority of the United States and thus an agency under the Administrative Procedure Act?
Now, do you have tax court funds to pay for the answer to that question?
So this is that's an excellent question, and one that I don't claim a lot of knowledge over the answer. So the federal government occasionally charters corporations on its own dime, and those corporations are different than the agencies or other instrumentalities of the United States. And to give you an out-of-date example, I think ComSat, the satellite corporation, was an example of a sort of federally chartered corporation. Amtrak is a federally chartered corporation, I believe.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, this is sort of the point of the Lebron case that I mentioned, which Justice Scalia examined whether Amtrak was the government for purposes of the Constitution, despite the fact that when Congress created Amtrak, it expressly said it's not an instrumentality or agency of the U.S. government. Justice Scalia said that's well and good for statutory purposes because Congress gets to decide statutes, but as will decide whether it's a constitutional, for constitutional purposes, whether it's a it's the government or not. And that's sort of my point. In my remarks, one of the points is, you know, when this has happened before, Congress has actually considered this question. And some corporations that it's involved in or creates, it decides to make them government agencies, like the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, I believe. And others, it expressly says they're not. And it makes decisions about these things based on its policy judgments and you know, hearings and process. We don't really know the answer to what AIG is or GM or Chrysler, at least in terms of what the Congress thinks. So it'll be left to the courts ultimately to make some of those determinations when these lawsuits are brought.
I'll add to that that so what about a corporation that sells essentially only to one outfit, and that is makes all its money from a, say, government contract, like a private prison or something like that? My sense is that the courts have been somewhat unwilling to hold those sorts of corporations liable under, say, Section 1983 or Bivens. So the answer is clearly quite complicated.
I think I would definitely agree with that. I think one of the distinctions about the present circumstance from the corporate law side of things is that the history of government corporations has either involved federal chartering or state chartering, in which the government doesn't, in which the government owns equity, but it's not publicly traded. But that the perfect storm that really creates all of these circumstances that are my focus are publicly traded, state chartered, and government ownership. Right. So, you know, like Fannie was publicly traded, but the government didn't own shares. So I think those unique circumstances all coming together really throw a wrench in everything we know about corporate securities law with respect to TARP recipients. I think that's the big issue.
So the short answer to your question, Mark, is that the situation is good for lawyers and bad for investors. Yes.
Hi, Paul Johnson. I have a three-part question. What would have happened last year?
Three-part question is cheating.
I'll just make it one sentence. last year when we had a collapse, what if the government had done nothing? Did government need to be involved? Secondly, Mr. Birnbaum, you indicated that we're not through this. Do you expect another collapse of the magnitude we experienced 14 months ago? And in 40 words or less, could you just state what government actions actually contributed to the collapse of a year ago?
I'll start with two and three. I don't think I'm qualified to address the first. I don't believe we're through this by anywhere near the mark. I'm hopeful, you know, the recent administration announcements on the Home Affordable Mortgage Program, 600,000 of these modifications are in process, is hopeful, but anyone in the industry knows there's a lot of fallout from those numbers. Also, there's been a lot of reluctance by private investors and servicers to buy into the government program. There's a waterfall of private sector products, ironically, that still have things like interest-only loan products to help consumers through on a short term, which are not sustainable for the long term. The fact of the matter is that, you know, we have upwards of 10 million at-risk consumers. You know, so programs that reach 1 million, 2 million on a case-by-case basis are not going to help property values, are not going to help consumers, are not going to help the investors. And that's why we're interested in bulk solutions. I quickly touched earlier on a proposal that we spoke of over a year and a half ago, which we called To Help Now. The idea was to use the market to, in fact, help self-correct. Wall Street for years has had a vehicle, we've actually spoken to Wall Street Without Walls, where there is a reverse auction process to sell off parts of portfolios on the marketplace. If, in fact, interested parties would begin to sell these portfolios in a reverse auction process to Treasury or another government agency, a home loan corporation similar to that was done during the Depression, whatever it may be, those loans could then be scrubbed to become 30-year fixed rate. The savings, because there would be a substantial savings right now based on the property values, the value of the tranches, would then be used to modify the loans down to an affordable rate for the consumers. And then guess what we would do with the conventional 30-year fixed rates? The government would not hold them. They would sell them back to the investment community. So virtually no cost to the government. Rather than buying bad loans, rather than investing in the banks. This is what's holding the banks and everyone back right now. They're still holding the paper. So that's one practical solution that Treasury and others are beginning to look at. As far as the forecast, clearly there are a lot of motivated parties right now. The problem, though, is the current system is not working to facilitate solutions like Help Now or others. And I'll close with just a passing thought. I mean, if we're talking about what if we let the banks fail, well, what if we let homeowners use judicial modification or bankruptcy protection? Credit Suisse and others argue that we would save about a third of the properties right now that are facing foreclosure. And it's not easy, as you all know, as counsel, to qualify for bankruptcy protection. And there are a lot of compromises in the bills that were passed. I fully expect we're going to see that come back next year as legislation again as the numbers continue to rise in foreclosure.
I perhaps want to echo the kind of stirring speech we heard last night from Judge Ginsburg. But by way of saying, we hear a lot about aligning the interests of executives and administrators who the government regulates with the shareholders. We hear a little less about the possibility of the government as a shareholder necessarily aligning itself with these other shareholders rather than potentially elevating its own interests. And realistically, since the political branches operate on, you know, kind of, if you're a congressman, your long-term interest is the election in 2 years. And so I think the only branch possibly that could provide some enforcement here would more likely be the judicial branch, which I don't mean in necessarily in a substantive way, but I mean by enforcing the procedural checks. And David, I think, referred to it in his comments about the TARP. I mean, there's no delegation run as riot as the TARP, and yet, we have great problems with standing, even if it's after the fact and has very little impact on those actual decisions and what happens with GM, is there merit here to attempting to mount legal challenges to that kind of delegation?
Well, it was attempted in the context of the bankruptcy of Chrysler, and the Second Circuit said the language of the definition of financial institution is essentially broad enough to mean whatever the Secretary of Treasury says it means. Essentially it means any corporation that the Secretary decides to spend TARP money on. And I don't think there was, I don't recall a delegation issue being raised in that context. But if there was, I'm sure it would have gotten the answer that is the standard one, which is there is no such thing.
And I think this is where Corker Warner could come in and maybe play some sort of a role to have an independent trust, independent trustees, you know, who can stand up to the Treasury and stand up to Congress as well. And I think this is where the issue of sovereign immunity comes in as well, and the sovereign immunity protections in the EESA and more generally. And the fact that, you know, I think some judicial review of Treasury's decisions as a shareholder could be good. But I think also one step removed from that, even in advance of that, Treasury having more incentive to go talk to the OLC and get opinions and get advice, I think could be good, because I think that dynamic in advance of litigation is good. And I think sovereign immunity, you know, just gives you no reason to drop a line to the OLC.
And your comment about the relation of government shareholders to other shareholders is an interesting one in the context of GM and Chrysler, because, of course, the government decided that all the other shareholders of those companies would be completely wiped out, and that the ownership interest in those two companies would be whatever the government determined it should be. And that's exactly what occurred. If you were a common shareholder of GM or Chrysler, your shares were rendered worthless.
We have one more question.
Thank you. Jordan Abshire from the legal recruiting company Lateral Link. Growing up in the same hometown in Louisiana as JW, I don't have very much faith in government, and generally...
It was something he did or something about the town?
Well, no, it's actually nothing to do with JW or our town. It's more the history of government officials in the state favoring one company over another in unjust ways. So my question is to David, and I guess it's sort of related to the last one. I'm wondering if you've noticed to this point whether GM or the government has engaged in, anti-competitive actions that might adversely impact Ford. And I'm wondering what sort of recourse you think you might have if they do.
Well, I, to be perfectly honest, we have not seen anything. We're, you know, keeping a close eye or as close an eye as we can on what those companies do. We haven't seen anything that particularly gives us pause, except for the fact, I mean, the basic fact that they have access to low-cost capital. They don't have to pay back their debts because they were wiped out in the process. I mean, so there is a competitive, obviously just a general competitive disadvantage that comes from going through the process that they went through, which we frankly had no interest in going through. And we believe we're better served by not having gone through it. Certainly our shareholders are. The issue really is, though, how would we know? What would we see that would be evidence to us of, things that were going on in the government? Look, I believe the government's acting, the officials are acting in good faith. I believe GM's acting in good faith. But what guides their good faith? What are the proper ends of their investment? I mean, I think we need to have not just their own determination of what they think is the best policy, but a real exercise in actually making public policy and law that determines what's going to happen with those companies. And transparency. I mean, transparency is absolutely critical for companies that are owned by the government to be completely transparent about what they're doing, what are their contacts with the government, what are their interactions, sort of a FOIA reading room type approach would be helpful. So there's a lot of kind of watchful diligence on our part to see how that develops.
And I think in that vein, on the banking side, I think we've already seen some accountability issues to shareholders. I think I'm convinced that Secretary Paulson demanded that Ken Lewis violate the federal securities laws, and I think that he did as a result. And I think that goes to accountability, and I think, you saw the SEC come back with, I think, some preferential regulatory treatment in the SEC enforcement settlement. I think Judge Rakoff was right to reject that settlement attempt. I think, that goes to accountability, and I think that goes to transparency in government.
On a smaller note, NCRC has filed a complaint against a subsidiary of AIG, Wilmington Finance. It was a very clear-cut issue of redlining from our perspective. The company would not underwrite loans in the city of Baltimore's row house community, and demographically that community is overwhelmingly African-American.
At one point, a decade ago, there were some issues with appraisal fraud. Long gone, long gone. Most of the other major lenders, all of them, frankly, do business there. The interesting footnote for this group is that we filed an administrative fair housing complaint to HUD. HUD began to investigate the complaint after negotiation to mediate failed. And in fact, now AIG has been issued a subpoena by the Department of Justice because they refused to collaborate with HUD on the investigation of this really rather modest civil rights complaint. So it raises very interesting questions with regard to the issue we're talking about here. I mean, fair housing is national public policy. You had a government agency trying to investigate a complaint. They said, no, we're not going to turn over underwriting and related documentations about originations. And in fact, here we are. The government arguably is in court against a company it holds.
Just another example of the left hand not knowing what the far left hand is doing. While we're down to footnotes, by the way, I should add, David didn't say this, but he did not fly down in his private jet. He was driven down here by the general counsel of GM in a Ford. I want to thank everyone for coming. I want to thank our panel members. Please join me in thanking the panel. Have a great day.